Arkansas mountains of western Arkansas, where the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Guerrilla Media Network presents The Reynolds Revealed, a new weekly show that, no matter the limitations that may trammel inquiry elsewhere, sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today is Tuesday, March 19, 2013. This is episode number 6 of The Reynolds Reveal. I very much appreciate you for being part of the show. And yes, we do welcome your calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network. The number is 218-862-9829. I'll repeat that later in the show more than once. Now, last week, I think we had a very good show. We had guest John Lear, the famous retired pilot, and we discussed his analysis of 9/11 at all four events on 9/11/2001, and his experience and expertise as a pilot clarified a number of things for us, I do believe. My guests on today's show hail from the UK, England, to be more exact. We will have Andrew Johnson and Richard D. Hall on the line to discuss 7/7 and 9/11, with a special focus on Richard's important work in 3D modeling of the flight path or paths of the objects that approached the South Tower on 9/11 in 2001. And Richard reaches the surprising conclusion that the paths are identical in these various videos, the tapes that he was able to analyze. So we're going to see down the road in this show where this research is leading, what the criticisms are, and maybe we're on the cusp of a breakthrough in our understanding of what happened on 9/11. But first, I want to have you considered these Reynolds Revealed comments on the news. I think the most important item is tomorrow, March 20, is the 10th anniversary of the Iraq invasion by the U.S. government. And the first thing I think of as an economist is Larry Lindsey. Back in the day, he was an economic advisor to President George W. Bush, and Lindsey was a director of the National, something in the White House called the National Economic Council. He was a former governor of the Federal Reserve Central Bank, and he said in September of 2001 that an Iraq war might reach as high as $200 billion in cost. Well, the defense secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, said baloney. Other high officials in the administration were negative. I mean, this was going to be a walk in the park. And then they were even promising, which is something is outrageous and very illegal by international law, that it was going to pay for itself because we were going to steal their oil. Well, what do we have now? Tomorrow's the 10th anniversary. We have officially 4,488 U.S. military personnel dead, countless wounded and damaged. It's much disputed how many Iraqis have been killed. I think it's over a million, but I'd say conservatively 600,000 Iraqis, and then how many wounded and damaged, and the country in an absolute mess, allegations of depleted uranium everywhere. Joseph Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize winner in economic science, and his co-author, Harvard professor Linda Bilmes, put out a book in 2008 where they called the book's title is The $3 Trillion War, Including All Hidden Costs. And this has been attacked to some extent successfully as double counting and the like. But there was a study out by the Joint Economic Committee where I served actually 1 year in the mid-90s. They estimated it at $3.5 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office estimated it between $1.4 and $2.2 trillion. And one of the parts of the cost that Stiglitz and Vilmos included was a raise in the price of oil that would cost U.S. industry $500 billion. So, but what's remarkable is that this $200 billion, everybody agrees, it was passed long ago. By the way, the then-Fed governor, Larry Lindsey, an economist, a PhD economist from Harvard, he also called the stock market bubble back in 1996. And, of course, the NASDAQ price, stock prices declined beginning in March 2000. So let's go on to the next issue, which is President Obama will be visiting in Israel tomorrow. And Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government are going to ask Obama to strike according at Syrian missiles, according to a couple of news accounts. Or in other words, pressure Obama to take an active role in the Syrian conflict. Syria, the argument is that Syria is allegedly going to transfer missiles to Hezbollah and therefore strike at Israel. Or Netanyahu is going to try and get a concession that Obama will at least fully support Israel's military action to prevent the transfer. And the Israeli government's also going to attempt to lower the U.S. threshold for military action against Iran. We just don't have enough, you know, on our plate as far as war making, do we? It's absolutely outrageous. All these unnecessary, unprovoked wars. Remember the WMD argument. Oh, the argument that Saddam Hussein is Hitler and posing a big threat to the United States. Lie after lie. Well, let's go local. I'm going to go local now because the Arkansas legislature is in session, and this also always provides a lot of amusement. And here's the headline. Unpasteurized milk bill fails to get out of House committee. You'll recall a week or two ago I mentioned fluoridation was as part of the debate here in Arkansas. And there's a House bill, 1536, which would allow the sale of unpasteurized milk at Arkansas farms. Oh, well, wouldn't this be terrible? It wouldn't be pasteurized, that is, heated up to high temperatures, all in the interest of our health, supposedly. Even though people have been consuming unpasteurized or raw milk with very good effect for at least 10,000 years. Well, says the sponsor of this bill to allow a sale of up to 500 gallons of a month of raw milk. I think it's a matter of time, he says, until it passes. It's hard to imagine a more natural food than raw milk. Raw milk fans say it tastes better than pasteurized milk and that it's more healthful. Critics say unpasteurized milk is a health hazard. Well, the sponsor says to allow it. Eating any raw food carries some risk, yes, including peanut butter or spinach. And he says, quote, far more people have become ill, even to the point of death, from eating vegetables than from any other type of food product. The risk of drinking raw milk is minuscule. And that's absolutely right. Well, it couldn't get out of committee. So, by the way, it's legal to trade and consume unpasteurized goat milk. And in some states, it is legal to consume and to produce and consume raw milk. Well, one more item here, and that is, came across my desk, Amity Schles, who's the author of a new book called Coolidge. And this lecture is called Cal Coolidge and the Moral Case for Economy, by which she means, and Cal Coolidge meant economy and government. And if nothing else, this shows you how far we've come from the 1920s, when Cal Coolidge succeeded Warren G. Harding, who died in office, and Coolidge was the vice president in 1923, and he was elected overwhelmingly in 1924. And Coolidge is an interesting president because he alienated most people in Washington, D.C., but he was very popular in the country. And Coolidge said, quote, "It is much more important to kill bad bills than to pass good ones," unquote. That's what he told his father. And he used the veto liberally. Harding only vetoed six bills, but Coolidge vetoed 50, including farming subsidies, even though he was from farming country. And one of his favorite tactics was called the pocket veto. And it was a way to stop a bill without a veto message and without even affording Congress a chance to override the veto. Now, one of the reasons he was so successful in economy and government is his consistency. At one point, the housekeeper at the White House proudly showed the president the spread for a big dinner. And instead of receiving praise, she was scolded for serving, quote, "an awful lot of ham," unquote. She departed soon after. Here's another example of how he set the pace. The Hurricane Katrina of the Coolidge years was the great Mississippi River flood of 1927, and it heavily damaged the large parts of the South. Yet Coolidge made it a point to not visit the devastated area. He sent Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover in his place, and he was concerned that a presidential visit would encourage the idea of federal spending on disaster relief. And there were plenty of advocates in Congress, and he wanted to not go there. This reminds me of a previous president, Grover Cleveland. And I think I'll ignore that one, but that was the famous Texas seed bill that he vetoed in 1887. Coolidge and his budget director met every Friday morning before cabinet meeting to identify budget cuts and discuss how to say no to the requests of cabinet members. This is quite in contrast to, oh, don't you, you know, the higher budget requests, and even if they couldn't spend their previous year's budget entirely without subterfuge, this whole, it's such a refreshing a change from what we see today. And Coolidge made it a big moral point that there's got to be a economy and government because it comes out of the hides of the people. He made a moral case for saying no. And here's one of the pleasures of saying no. At one point, I was director of our graduate program in economics at Texas A&M University. And if you would say no, they all go away, right? If the graduate students that you're supervising, you say no, that sets the tone. If you say yes to one student, yeah, I'm going to put you on a research assistantship or a teacher assistantship, I'd get 8 or 10 more students in my office looking for, this improved lifestyle that they would have. So, but you say no, if you're a hardened hoe, you just have a much nicer life. And by contrast, we see politicians, they keep on saying yes to the, and once you, of course, allow that, you've set the tone, you've set the principle in effect, indirectly, if not directly. Okay, I've got time, I think, now to go back to Grover Cleveland, who some people would claim was the last great Democrat president. And back in that day, the ideology of limited government was very powerful compared to how weak it is today. And Grover Cleveland in 1887, this is a memorable manifestation of his conviction. This was his first term as president, and Congress passed the so-called Texas seed bill. And it provided for distributing seed grain by the U.S. Commissioner of Agriculture, why there is one. Hey, we don't have a commissioner of software or commissioner of, I guess we have a commissioner of automobiles now, unfortunately. Okay, the U.S. Commissioner of Agriculture could distribute seed grain to destitute farmers in an area of Texas devastated by drought. It was only $10,000. It was trifling even for those days, and it was appropriated. And the beneficiaries, of course, seemed deserving. Yet Cleveland vetoed the bill because he said he could, quote, find no warrant for such an appropriation in the Constitution, unquote. And further, Cleveland said, a prevalent tendency to disregard the limited mission of the government's power and duty shall be steadfastly resisted to the end that the lesson should be constantly enforced that though the people support the government should not support the people. How come we've come so far from that 19th century view of the limited mission of governments where economy is essential? By contrast, today, here's a column by Paul Krugman, the notorious Princeton economist who's a regular at the New York Times. And he, in his headline, says, what deficit crisis? We can't have enough government spending. Okay, we are going to move on to our guest, and I'm excited to have, hopefully we'll have Andrew Johnson from England and Richard D. Hall from that same bucolic kingdom on after our break, and we're going to talk about 9/11, but first we're going to talk about 7/7 because I think most Americans don't know about that so-called terrorist event in London. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we here at the Guerrilla Media Network welcome your calls. If you would like to call and speak with our guests later in the program, the number is 218-862-9829. We have on the line Richard D. Hall from England. He has been doing sterling work. Both he and we hope to have Andrew Johnson also on from England on the line. We're having a little difficulty there, but hopefully Andrew Johnson will be along shortly. Both of my guests have done such wonderful work on 9/11 in particular, which is a huge interest of mine. I think they deserve such praise for their objectivity, their determination, their intelligence, and both in their research work and in their outreach efforts. Now, Richard, I've got to tell you that this weekend I was listening to a lot of Irish music. And St. Patrick's Day was on Sunday, and I said, well, that's in their neighborhood. I wonder if I can bridge that attention paid to St. Paddy's Day and all the celebration that goes on here in the States. And I did find a connection in that it turns out that the producer of the 7/7, what's the title now? It escaped 7/7 Ripple Effect.
Yeah.
Ripple Effect, which sure. Richard has featured this work and done numerous interviews. It turns out that the producer maker there is an Irishman.
Well, he's actually an Englishman, but he's living in Ireland.
Okay.
Yeah.
He's living in Ireland. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm able to make that link.
I guess he's safer over there because it's a long story. The guy you're talking about is Anthony John Hill, and that guy made a film, I think, in 2007. About the 2005 London bombings, and he was extradited from Ireland, and he was put in prison for 150 odd days, and he was found completely innocent. And his crime was that he sent copies of his film to a judge to be considered in a trial in the UK, where they were trying to make guilty some friends of these of the alleged bombers. So it's quite a long involved story.
Let's back up, Richard. So let's get the government story, the official story, and then the mainstream media supported story about what happened. That they claim that there were four young Muslims, males, who set off bombs, three in the tube, and one on a double decker bus, right?
Yeah. Briefly, the story is this: the official story that three guys from a place called Leeds in the UK, which is in the north of England, they set off in a car and got to a place called Luton, which is the train station there. They met another guy who came from Aylesbury. They congregated in the car park of the train station. They made about an hour-long trip to London. And then when they got to London, three of them walked off on three separate tube lines, and they allegedly had backpack bombs, and they caused carnage, setting their bombs off simultaneously. The fourth alleged bomber, about an hour later, allegedly got on a bus and detonated his bomb. And in total, there were 52 people killed, or 56 if you include the alleged four. But there are so many holes in this story. We'd be here for 24 hours if I was to go through all of them. But, you know, I can highlight some of the key flaws in the official story.
Well, we want to do that. It's sort of like a top three that proves the official story is a lie. But I want to jump ahead. Let's assume that the government is complicit, or the intelligence services are culpable, and this would have had to come from the top of the government, presumably. Although maybe not necessarily, ordinarily it would.
Yeah.
And what would be the motive? So in other words, let's assume we already have established who did it. And now I want to ask the question, why? What's the motive?
Well, I think the motive in the UK case, the support for the actions in the Middle East was waning in the UK. Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at that time, there was a lot of anti-war feeling. Thousands of people had been marching in the streets in London against the UK supporting the US's various wars in the Middle East. And I think they needed a second major nation to be, you know, heavily involved with the US. They needed that, and a false flag event was achieved that objective for them, I think.
Is there a great deal of war weariness in the UK, Richard, would you say?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think most people are aware of, let's just call it, the background noise. You know, they see these stories in the newspapers of what's going on in the Middle East, but I don't think most people have detailed, objective analysis of what's really going on. They see the stories and they just believe them. And if you actually sort of challenge somebody, well, what's your information? What's your sources? How do you know this? Most people, they're quite easy to convince that false flag is going on, but you have to get their attention first.
I saw you on one of your video appearances where I think you made a powerful point that basically things change because of the activity of the 5% or 10% at most. Really, it's much of the public is inert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, I would agree, obviously. And I don't know what the exact figure is, but they work hard, I think, to keep that figure below a certain value, the people who really are critically analysing the information and trying to find the truth. But they've got this thing called the mainstream media, which is absolutely huge, and there's billions of pounds spent on it, and it's got people's minds convinced of their version of events. So
is the print media any better than the BBC or the broadcasters? Would you say, is there any integrity there?
No, definitely not. If you go into a news agents in the UK and you look at the headlines, I mean, I go in to get a pint of milk every day in my local store, and I'll look at the headlines, and it's sometimes they make me laugh, sometimes they make me cry, but they're just so transparent, in my opinion, propaganda. Then there's no truth seeking in there. Well, the print media is awful in the UK, in my opinion.
So they're prostitutes, right?
Yeah.
Lamestream.
Yeah.
That's
and they even have slightly different versions. So they have some of the newspapers are controlled opposition to the other newspapers. The Daily Mirror is considered slightly alternative, a little bit more left-wing, but it's actually just a controlled opposition to the others.
Is there a loss of trust in government over this
I would say not over the fact that people think it was orchestrated by intelligence agencies or the government. The vast majority of people don't realize this. They think that it was failings in the intelligence services which allowed Al-Qaeda or whoever to get away with this attack. That's your standard view, and that was what was put across at the bogus inquest that they had, this sort of phony investigation, which was just a whitewash.
Oh, was that was Lady Hallett.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go back to the evidence and what key things prove that the government account is impossible. Sure. I was watching your videos yesterday, and I didn't see much attention to the claim that the forensic work shows that these bombs, in at least in the tubes, maybe even on the double-decker bus, had to come from below the frame. In other words, that they were attached from below rather than would have gone off from a knapsack or a backpack. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, there was the testimony of the driver of one of the tubes who says that the tube train lifted up off the tracks. There are various witnesses on the carriage who said that the metal was bent upwards from the carriage. And there's also the testimony that in one of the cars, these train cars, there were actually three separate holes some distance apart. So it's not consistent with a single suicide bomber setting off a backpack. And the evidence was destroyed. So they actually destroyed the three main carriages that contained these alleged bombs. And so we haven't got them to forensically examine in the government inquest. So that was actually a criminal act of destroying evidence, perverting the course of justice. Those train cars should have been stored and quarantined.
Yeah, that's an admission of guilt. When you, as you say, it's a separate, independent criminal offense. It takes me back to John F. Kennedy's assassination and what they did with the limousine right away, or destroying evidence at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and so on. It's interesting how easy though people are stampeded. Right away, we know that these were Muslim terrorists, even though they've got no proof, right? Yeah. I mean, the media just go right along with it with some slips, to be sure, right? In other words, where some honest reporters on the street are reporting conflicting evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they've, in the past, obviously prior to 2005, in both the US, the UK, and probably other countries, they've got these fake media stories or events or psychological operations, whatever you want to call them, the media element of it, they've got that down to a fine art, I think, good enough to get away with it from the majority of people. And so they have their tentacles into all of the mainstream publications and television channels. So they would have to have that control in order to get away with a false flag attack. And they absolutely do have, in my opinion.
That's more important. Having that opinion control is more important than pulling off a really slick, mistake-free crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they can cover up virtually anything with 98% of the public, it seems. Rich, we should point out here that listeners who want to know more about a 7/7, the terror event in 2005 in London, can learn a lot more and buy DVDs at richplanet.net.
Yes, it's richplanet.net. The top left-hand corner of the site, there's a link which says 7/7 shows. So there's, I don't know, maybe a dozen TV shows all about the 7/7 bombings. They don't need to buy them. They can watch them free of charge from that website. So there's a number of programs that I've made and other ones made by other researchers. So it's a good starting point for people to get.
So let's talk about the four alleged perpetrators, or really patsies. Now, they really existed.
Sure, yeah.
And they appear, at least some of them, if not all of them, were part of the intelligence apparatus, perhaps infiltrators into Muslim groups.
Yeah.
So what happened to them on that morning?
Right. Well, my view on it, having looked at the evidence, is that they were duped into thinking they were taking part in a mock terrorist training exercise. And this training exercise needed three Muslim suicide bombers with fake backpacks on them. So they just thought they were taking part in this drill. But several things happened which meant that they didn't get to their targets in time, i.e. they didn't get on the tube trains that were supposed to blow up with them on it. There was a train cancelled, which meant that they were late. And also, we now believe that Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who was the alleged ringleader, we believe that he didn't even travel down to London, and that there was only two travelled from Leeds. And this has been uncovered by Dr. Nick, or spoken about by Dr. Nick Colostrom, one of the main 7/7 researchers. So we think that when they got to London, or shortly after their train arrived, the tube trains, the bombs had already gone off. So these
guys...
Okay,
we're going to resume our conversation. We'll finish up on 7/7 on the other side of the break with our guest from England, Richard D. Hall. This is the Reynolds Reveal. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you'd like to call, we have Andrew Johnson from England joining us, along with Richard D. Hall from England. The number to call is 218-862-9829. That number again, 218-862-9829. And Richard, I wanted to finish up on our discussion of 7/7 and get your comment on these reports that a couple of young Muslim males were shot near HSBC and some other bank site in London.
Yeah, it was HSBC and the Credit Suisse Bank, I believe. Now, this is probably the most controversial element of this story, because I think it shows that that there is some unit, military unit in the UK that has license to kill people, which the police have no sort of reign over. And I think that's the reason why this has been probably the most covered up element. There are alleged truth films about 7/7, which they'll point out all of the bog standard holes in the official narrative, but they won't go near the Canary Wharf element. And I believe that is the most sensitive part of this, because this is where these patsies were murdered, because their false flag thing that they'd constructed had gone wrong. The patsies got on the wrong train. They were late. They realized they were late, so they fled. And all evidence points to the fact that they fled to Canary Wharf. And I believe that they also spoke to a woman called Mariam Hyman, who was also killed. And the official story says that she was on the number 30 bus, which was nowhere where she was headed. She was headed to Canary Wharf as well. And I also have information from another Muslim-looking man who was he was surrounded by 10 armed police on the same train line that the alleged Patsies, that the Patsies would have been on, but they changed tube and then went headed east to Canary Wharf, where we believe they were shot.
Andrew, unfortunately, you didn't hear Richard's exposition about 7-7, but we've spent at least 15 minutes. I thought it was a useful thing to do here in America, where most listeners would know little about that event. And, what comment would you make about 7-7? Is it proof beyond a reasonable doubt that this is another false flag event, and the motives are obvious about UK participation in Mideast wars and the like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have no doubt that it was a false flag operation, and I'm sure Richard's sort of bullet-pointed the main pieces of evidence very well, because he's done an awful lot of research into this. Probably one of the people, you know, who's done the most research in the UK into the subject, because he's had a lot of contacts with various people and, you know, reviewed the evidence from the court inquest and so on. And, you know, I have no doubt that those people were, you know, Canary Wharf, and that whole narrative makes them much, it hangs together as being much more logical than this official nonsense where, you know, they come out with, and they couldn't have even got to London for the time of the supposed bombs going off anyway, because the train was cancelled. So, you know, and then we have this, I think, I'm sure that Richard would have mentioned it, and the Peter Power link with these exercises, yeah. And that was admitted on the day. And he actually went on live radio, and that was one of the first red flags for me that I became aware of, that he'd said these exercises were going on. So, you know, and then you have people like Rudy Giuliani. He's in London the day that this happened. You know, just by coincidence.
Yeah,
you know,
along with Netanyahu. Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, we've got the same old faces.
To get your take, and this will hopefully be my last question regarding 7-7, but I asked Richard also, you know, what's the mood do you get of the British public toward this? A strong majority believe the government, or are they suspicious about 7-7, and also, are they war weary?
Well, I think there's probably, you know, there's more of a Protestant movement in this country by tradition. There probably, if you were to do a poll, there are less people in this country, perhaps per capita, that would trust government, you know, than perhaps in the US, possibly. That's more of a guess. But nevertheless, people have a similar kind of, they don't really investigate. They may be suspicious, but they don't really act on those suspicions very much, and they don't go very deeply into it. And but speaking personally, you know, I interact with a lot of people who are involved in the sort of research that you and Richard are, but I don't actually interact with all that many people, you know, outside of those groups, really. So it's difficult for me personally to get a feeling of to how much scepticism there is of the official stories. You know, reading the press, I mean, you get bits and pieces cropping up in the press, but it's almost just to kind of feed that sector of the readership, and then they don't really, you know, go any further with it.
Let's then turn to Richard to discuss his fascinating and possibly a great breakthrough on his 3D modeling of the airplane images that head toward the South Tower on the morning of September 11, 2001. Now, just to set the stage where I'm coming from is, well, I know an airliner didn't crash, as the government says, the Boeing 767 on the United Airlines Flight 175. I know an airliner like that didn't crash into the building because of the evidence from the aftermath, from what I know would be a true. We know what air accidents and major airplane crashes look like, and that's not what we had after the hole was created in the tower. Mm-hmm. But how they did it, that is, I believe some of these witnesses are very credible that saw some kind of an airplane image. Some say they heard. Now, it's true, a heavy majority of the witnesses didn't see or hear something. So it's kind of a mixed bag on eyewitnesses. But still, I do believe some of the witnesses that they saw. For example, there was a NYPD helicopter participant who was out there right near that flight approach or path of this South Tower penetrating airplane image, and he said it looked like an evil magician's trick. Now, in other words, that guy is credible with me, as are other witnesses who say they saw something. So this is fascinating what Richard's done. I had a co-author who was an MIT materials engineer working on a PhD at MIT, and we co-authored a few pieces. His name is Rick Ryder, and he started in on this, Richard, and he gave up because of the different perspectives or location of the video camera. So this is a fascinating thing you've done. Explain, if you would, Richard, Paul, how you went about tracking the flight paths of these different airplane images.
All right. Well, let's just point out first that there are many pieces of evidence which lead me to suspect that possibly 767s were not involved. And two of those facts are, the first is the speed is actually impossible. The 767s cannot travel at speed, and I've measured the speed quite accurately using the 3D model, 583 miles per hour at sea level. And critics of that say, oh, well, they were in a dive. Well, they weren't in a dive. They were in a descent. So that's the first problem. The second is...
Hey, even this agrees with that, Richard, if I could interrupt. Yeah. I think they say there's something like a 6-degree descent flight path. Sure. In other words, moderate.
Right, yeah. Now, the other fact is the impact physics, which I think you've done a little bit of work on, Morgan, in the past. Now, this, if you take two of the closest images of the second plane going into the South Tower, which just so happened to be amateur video, the mainstream didn't get close-ups or that they've put out. I suspect they may have some hidden away in a cupboard somewhere. But if you look at those videos, they're not consistent with a 767 hitting the size of a steel building. No bits of the wings break off. The plane melts into the building, and there is hardly any deceleration. So
by the way, missed degrees that there were.
Yeah.
Little or no deceleration.
All of these various pieces of evidence has sparked what's called the no planes theory. Now, the no planers, as they are known, is broadly split into two camps. That is, people who think that nothing actually appeared in the sky, and that the TV and some of the amateur video clips have been modified or planes inserted, okay, before they were aired. There's a second camp which thinks that things that which looked like planes did appear in the sky, and that what was videoed was actually happening, but they just weren't real planes. In other words, they're
fake
planes.
We're going to learn more from Richard D. Hall and Andrew Johnson from England on the other side of the break. This is D. Reynolds Revealed, so stay with us. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and I am speaking with Andrew Johnson and Richard D. Hall from England. And prior to the break, Richard was explaining that there are two groups of no planers. And sure. Please resume, Richard.
Yeah, so briefly, you've got the planes were fake, but the videos were real, and you've got the videos are fake. So there you go. Now,
and there were no planes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So... Now, I initially was led down the path of, I thought it was video fakery that was used. And I watched a very interesting film called September Clues, and there was two or three things in that film that I was really intrigued by. One of these things was called the NBC ball clip. This is a news footage clip where the alleged plane is seen to come. It seems to come at a much steeper angle than all of the other clips, but I've since realized that it's not the alleged object is not coming from a steeper angle. It just looks that way because the camera is at a much higher viewpoint. Now, I made a video trying to work out the path, just to try and determine if this was a different object to the alleged planes, okay? And I concluded originally that it was, okay, that I thought it had a different path. But I did get some criticism of that video, and I decided to make a much, much more detailed three-dimensional model. I used a package called Google SketchUp, which is a scale model of the Twin Towers, plus a few other buildings in there as well. I also used a map of the ground, which is in perfect scale to the vertical axis. And then what I did was I plotted the official flight path, which I got from an official government report, in that model. So I've got a line in that model. And then I started comparing that to all of the video evidence to see if the we've got about 50-odd video clips. I think I used 26 video clips of this, of the second plane impacting, alleged plane impacting, because some of them, there was only a few frames you could use. They weren't suitable to be used with the 3D model. But the conclusion was that every piece of video footage of the second alleged plane matched. So they were following the same path. So my conclusion from that was that video fakery can't have been used to create these images of planes, because there were just too many people captured it, and they all matched. Okay, so that
Richard, to clarify, you had the path from a Richard Bauer study that was commissioned by NIST, was it, or NTSB?
Daniel R. Bauer, I think it was.
Daniel R. Bauer, yes. Yeah. And then you had this military flight path.
Yeah.
Explain that.
Yeah, I downloaded that from a website. I don't recall which one it was, but it's confirmed to be official data from the RADES system. Now, in the video, I found this anomaly that these two paths, they're similar, but they're spaced by 1,400 feet. So there's a huge discrepancy between the two of them. Now, in that video, I suggest that perhaps one of these paths is some kind of secret projector, and the other path is the actual where the plane appears. In other words, the official flight data. Now, it's been pointed out to me since then that the reason why these paths are different is because the radar head was over 60 miles away from the tower, so you get a system error. So there's a reason for that, okay? So that's something which needs to be corrected in my film. But it still does not detract from the fact that there's impossible speed and impossible impact dynamics. So I'm of the mind that the plane was not real. I don't know how it was constructed. I don't like to use the word hologram, but I do think people witnessed what looked like a plane in the sky. But I'm convinced that it can't have been a plane. Now,
are you saying, Richard, to clarify,
sure,
the radar's data perhaps are in error because the source was 60 miles away?
Mm. Yeah, you get with the radar system, you'll get what's called a system error, which, in other words, each radar return is offset by the same amount. So it's not like a random error. So all the points are shifted 400 feet to one side. Sorry, 1,400 feet.
Okay. So it may be, if this system error were corrected, that the two paths would coincide.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Do you know why they wouldn't correct that error, though, but, you know, before they actually made the data public, or is it just kind of because it's raw data that's come straight out of the instrument? Have you had any thoughts on that?
I don't know why it's not corrected. I guess it is just raw data. The military data only provides a return every 12 seconds, which is less than what's in the Daniel R. Bauer report. But One of the videos that I'd like to draw attention to, and I don't think this has been widely publicized, if you watch my film, which you can watch from richplanet.net /911.bhp, if you look at clip number 9, I'd really like to draw people's attention to this because I think this gives a clue as to how this illusion was constructed. There are two clips, one known as the Herzakhani clip, which is a close-up of the alleged plane melting into the building. There's another one, which is clip 9 on my video, and it's shot a little bit lower down than the Herzakhani clip. Now, this clip's quite famous because the alleged plane comes in and the wing disappears in one frame, and then it reappears. Have you seen it? Have you seen that one at all?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would like to suggest what's happening there. If you look at that video clip very carefully, you'll see that the person operating the video camera is shooting into the sun, or the sky is very, very bright. So there's a building in the foreground which is extremely dark. Now, what that tells you is that he's got it on an automatic. He's got his camera set on auto, and it's selected a very fast shutter speed because he's shooting into the sun. Okay, and that's confirmed because the building in the foreground is dark. So he's operating at a very fast shutter speed. So I think because of that, his shutter is only open for a very small fraction of a second. He's actually caught the illusion in mid-projection. So let's just say that it's projecting it, I don't know, 200 frames per second, because I think they're going to select something which is higher than a television projection, okay? If you sample that at a very high shutter speed, it's possible that you can get in between the frames and see the illusion. And I think that's what we're seeing in clip 9 in my video. Now, that then adds weight to the fact that it was some form of projection. Now, we can speculate as to where the projector was. I'm open-minded on that now. Initially, I thought it was perhaps some parallel vehicle running 1,400 feet to the side of the projection, just projecting a fixed image. But now I think it may be inside, the projector may be inside the image, possibly. And that's something which David Shaler suggested.
Yeah, that was, you know, one idea. There was always talk about a missile, and then you have a or a drone, which could go 500 miles plus near sea level, could it project an airline or airplane-like image around itself?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's always this objection, well, you need a screen, you know. Could that be done through some kind of a gas or, project this image externally?
I can shed a little bit of light on that. If you go and look at all of the images, all of the videos, every one apart from one is set against a blue sky background. The one that isn't is the NBC ball footage. Because the camera is much higher, the backdrop is actually the river and the landscape. And strangely, that image, the plane does not look convincing. That's why it became known as the ball clip. The plane looked more like a ball. And I think whatever illusion they've created, I think it works better on a blue sky backdrop or a constant textured backdrop.
Hmm. It's interesting that if you look at the Pentagon event, because you have different investigators arriving at the same conclusion, namely that there was a flyover, you know, because you have the Craig Ranke Citizens Investigation Team having highly credible witnesses saying this plane came and north of the Pentagon Sitco station, contrary to the government story, it couldn't have crashed where the government where the damage is. And then you have the data that the pilots for 9/11 Truth analyzed, and they found that there was a flyover. Because they didn't readjust the altimeter, is the way I'd put it as a layman. But you have two separate groups who come to the same conclusion. And we would need further work. It would be reassuring if different credible investigators arrive at this kind of result, Richard,
mm-hmm.
that the path
I've not
is,
really- Yeah.
Go ahead.
I've not really researched the Pentagon one, just the fact that the wreckage would have been spewed all over the lawn. There would have been tail sections, and it just wasn't there. And plus the size of the hole.
Right.
There's so many. The fact that the FBI confiscated all of the film footage of security cameras in that region, it's blatantly, yeah.
Andrew, for his observation about Richard. What about the Richard's been subjected to criticisms, maybe some of it productive. What's going on there?
Well, I think Richard has quite a sort of intelligent audience for his program, which goes out weekly in the UK. And I think there are quite a few sort of engineers and people who are involved with airlines, or they know bits and pieces. And so they've contacted him with those sorts of intelligent comments. And I think so some of that reflects the different audience you get with a sort of genuine TV program than you get on internet forums, which are just trashed up and peed on at almost every opportunity. So I think the kind of Richard, the information that Richard gets via emails from his audience needs much less filtering than the stuff them wading through forums and stuff like that. So that's probably one comment I would make.
So there's been helpful criticism by people in the industry.
Well, I think to some extent that's what seems to have happened. I know I'm sure Richard could send us a bag of emails that weren't very nice, but we get those as well. So I agree with just about everything Richard has said. And the only point I would add is that there is also a second film which the second of the plane. Going into the tower. True, and that's one of the ones that was supposedly released with this NIST FOIA, and I think I'm pretty sure that's in Richard's film as well. But you can also see the wing of the plane disappearing in that. And to add a couple of thoughts to what Richard said in terms of the projection, I think if when you're looking at this image projection, then it explains the different colours of the plane, because in some of the shots it looks like a silvery, fairly realistic plane, and in some of them it looks completely black, even though you look at the angle of the sun and it seems to be it should be silvery. And then particularly if I'm thinking of the plane looks almost black, and then I've also suggested to people, and I've pointed this out in some of the talks I've done, that if people have stood at slightly different angles, then they may get a different sort of quality of image that they actually observe from that standpoint. So to some of them it appears like a big plane, and to some of them it appears like a smaller plane, and to some of them maybe it doesn't appear to have such big wings, so it looks more like a missile, because the image projection system, whatever it is not perfect. It doesn't give you a perfectly realistic image under all lighting conditions and from all observational standpoints. So I think when you add all those things up, the image projection evidence becomes a lot more compelling. And going back to the sort of the attacks that we've had. I mean, one of the people who became somewhat upset was Simon Shack, whose real name is Simon Hyten. And when Richard made this film, he and I had sort of coordinated our activities a little bit, because I'd already seen how Simon Shack had started to claim that all, and I repeat, all of the 9/11 videos from the World Trade Center were all fake, all of them. There was no real imagery there at all. And he then proceeded to claim that you therefore couldn't decide how the buildings were destroyed, because the video that you were using to make that judgment was fake, as were the photographs. And this is what he's gone around claiming for about the last 18 months, couple of years, and he's become louder and louder in this. And he's been quite successful in his own way as well, because I have a friend, and I've written about this, who became convinced that Simon Shack was right, and all these actors were employed at the scene to, give these fake stories, and then all the images were fake. And my friend wrote to me and said, are you sure that, Dr. Judy Wood is right, because, this guy's saying that all the images were fake, so you can't make a judgment. And
you know, it's just ridiculous. They claim you can throw away tens of thousands of pictures and many videos as well. Just ignore that, even though they're all consistent with the other kinds of evidence we have.
Exactly. And that was my biggest point with Simon Shack, that I said, look, you know, I said a couple of things to him. Look, firstly, the research of Dr. Wood is not just based on photographs and video. You know, you've got the seismic readings and the weather data and so forth. Oh, we've got another break coming up, I think.
Well, thank you, Andrew. We're speaking to Andrew Johnson and Richard B. Hall in England, where it's evening, and here it is in the Central Time Zone. Morgan Reynolds on the Reynolds New Deal. Please return after our break. How long? We are back. This is the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we are interviewing Andrew Johnson and Richard B. Hall in England. If you'd like to call and speak to our guest, the number 218-862-9829. Again, 218-862-9829. Well, I wanted to build on Andrew's remarks about the, we'll call it the instability of these images that we see in Flight 175. I interviewed one woman who was over, and I believe it was the Goldman Sachs building, quite credible. She was on about the 22nd story on the east side of downtown. And so she was a good six blocks, maybe eight blocks at most from the South Tower. And she observed that she saw the top of the plane, which she couldn't have done given the flight path. It hit around the 75th or 80th floor as a center point. And that here's another example of these images seem different to the various witnesses and on the videotapes. And then I have a general comment. This whole thing is very frustrating because the perpetrators were very smart in that they used mostly secret technology, both to destroy the World Trade Center in the form of directed energy weapons, which are semi-secret, and apparently in this imagery technology that they're using in broad daylight to project what seems to be an airliner, certainly an airplane. So, Richard, can you build on this? Am I wrong? Am I right?
Let's assume they have got this sort of technology where they can make it look as though there's a plane in the sky traveling along. Now, as soon as the general public know that that type of technology does exist, and it's very good and convincing, then that technology is useless. You can't use it again because people will question everything that they see then. So this is one reason why I think they need to keep this covered up. There are other reasons as well. But if we just look at as I said before, the two broad no-planer theories, the first is that there were no planes and the videos were faked. The second is that the planes were fake and the videos were real. Now, I think there's been quite a bit of disinformation put out on the internet to encourage theory number one, i.e. that there were no planes and all the videos were tampered with to insert planes. I think there's been a very sophisticated disinformation with various films being made. I don't want to name any, but I believe that's
what's
been going on.
Well, one name comes right to mind, Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could name one, Richard, that you know, you and I, Richard, haven't talked about, but I think Morgan and I have talked about him a bit. He goes back, probably goes back a few years, but
okay. Well,
he's still around as well.
The name also coincides with a card in a deck of cards.
It does, yes. I think it's often the first one in a deck, isn't it, or something? If I've got.
Okay.
And, yes, I think this particular fellow decided that he was very depressed, and he would actually take the ultimate sort of act, which people do, and then it turned out not
but
to be true.
But we're not going to name any names, are we, Andrew? But Richard,
no,
we interrupted.
But I thought it was interesting that this particular fellow who talked about this fakery would then actually indulge in an act of fakery himself. It was rather ironic that would come about.
And then we have his fakery when it comes to, we'll call it the Hutchison effect, right?
Yes, yeah. I mean, what the heck is going on with this guy, you know? I think Richard is absolutely right about the disinformation, and I had a thought while he was speaking there about, you know, going back to what Simon Schack has proceeded to do with claiming that all the video is fake. And this is kind of a very powerful psychological operation, which I think is kind of like mixed in with the psychology of what Richard said about this holographic or image projection technology, whatever name we tried to give it, which probably wouldn't be brilliant anyway. But if you look at what Simon Schack has tried to do, saying all the images are fake, then that's almost like he's trying to cover up that this technology is real. But then again, if it is real, then how many images, you know, can be faked of this nature? So, you know, it's kind of like a really it really messes with your head when you start to think about it, I suppose. And that's what they like doing, because then when you're in a state of quandary and you don't know what's going on, that's when you're open to manipulation, which is a large part of what this is all about.
Well, I think we could make a very strong statement in that Simon Schack and that group are in the evidence destruction business. Very much like the government is.
Yeah, so,
the no planes theory is just unheard of in mainstream. So if there is disinformation, it's internet-based. So it has to be attacking the place where these alternative theories, some of them possibly true, are coming about. So the disinformation is internet-based films rather than films that you would see on TV, because they're not the people they're trying to convince. Mm. And I'm not naming any names in saying that.
But you're pure. You stay pure, Richard. We got to have somebody who won't dirty his fingers.
There's not many people would call me that.
Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, a lot of people, one of the most widely asked questions after I did this analysis was, okay then, Richard, so what the hell happened to the planes and the passengers? Come on, tell us that. Now, let me just make one comment about that. I know somebody who is a travel agent and worked in the international flights department in a travel agency in 2001. And after the alleged flights had gone into the towers, she checked the status of the two flights. Now, when you get on a plane, you go through the gate, and when the last person goes through the gate, the person checking the people on the flight types that into a computer, and then that flight becomes flagged as closed. So the agents can't then book tickets on that flight, okay? So before a flight takes off, always, if a travel agent, because it's an international computer system, travel agent checks that flight, it's unbookable. You cannot book flights. Those two flights, you could still book tickets on them after they'd allegedly hit the towers. And she is a 100% reliable source on that.
Okay, now the American flight, you're speaking of Flight 11, of course, never existed officially.
Mm-hmm.
The two United flights, you know, Flight 93, the alleged crash near Shanksville, and the Flight 175, they existed in the ACARS, the NTSB database. So they officially existed. The two American flights, the Flight 77 and Flight 11, didn't. You know, Gerard Holmgren discovered this pretty early on.
Okay.
That's right. And I mean, I, you know, Richard and I have discussed this question a little bit, and I point people to the Loose Change number 2 film. I know some people like that film and some people hate it, but there's a 15-minute segment which I sort of clipped out and stuck on my YouTube channel, which goes through the plane stories, and it covers what you just said, Morgan, you know, with the NTSB records and so on. And it looks at some of the news reports that, two flights actually crossed over Cleveland Airport, and two flights landed about 20 minutes or half an hour apart and were disembarked, and all these passengers got off. And it goes through all the details of this, and, you know, say links it with some news reports which later apparently disappeared. But then all that information in that Loose Change film was then taken out of the next version, which was Loose Change Final Cut, which wasn't the final cut, but it's like almost, you know, looking at that film, those guys were pretty good. They got some pretty good information together for that second film and nailed some things down. And of course, it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but that film was also, as I like to say, thermite free. If you go and watch Loose Change number 2, it had no thermite in it because that hadn't come out then. And so it just had the bombs thing in, and it's actually a reasonably good film for the time that it was made. And as I say, they took all that plane stuff out in the next film, and I think that was the objective. They wanted to take that out because that, I think, helps to fill in some of the gaps in what happened to the passengers and the planes and stuff.
Well, Dylan Avery is very hostile to any dissenting word about airliner crashes at the World Trade Center. Are you suggesting maybe they changed their minds and when they went to Loose Change Final Cut, or somebody got to them, or was degraded on the airline?
I think they were persuaded with and I think if you watch Loose Change 2, they're not no-planers. They don't say no planes crashed, and they don't actually look at the actual evidence of the crash at all, but they kind of look into the backstory of the planes, I suppose you might call it, you know, where they took off from, what the records showed. And they actually point out that two of the flights weren't even supposed to have taken off. So I think they were probably thinking at that point this old nugget of the remote-controlled planes. You know, they weren't real passenger planes. They were remote-controlled military jets. You know, and this type of thing, which was again one of those theories that was put out there to try and explain how, you know, it could have got through air defence and stuff. But, you know, if these things were projections of some kind, then the air defence issue would never have arisen, because it was clearly been operated by people who could, you know, put whatever information they needed into the security or air defense networks to achieve what they achieved.
I'd like to point out that there's a very peculiar nature about the pilots from 9/11 Truth, but they have done, it seems to me, some very good work, at least from a layman's perspective. Establishing, for example, that the flight 175 shows it was in the air, if you believe the radar and the ATC and these this messaging system whose acronym I forgot right now, but that it's in the air, it's being picked up at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and then even as far west as Pittsburgh. Long after the hit in the South Tower, yet Rob Basalmo, who heads the pilots group, got into some kind of a wrestling match with Jim Fetzer, and Basalmo seems to be very adamant that he will never say that there were he would never be called a no-planer, you know. Somehow is defending, it seems, in effect, plane crashes as the government describes. I don't know what his position is. I've tried to invite him to be interviewed, but he won't ever respond to me. So in any case, the pilots for 9/11 Truth, John Lears had kind of some difficulty with him, but he stays with it because they have done some good work.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think some of the data that's been brought forward is still very useful, but it's just unfortunate they can't kind of divorce themselves and realise that these illusions were created with a certain purpose. And when I've given these talks a few times, I sort of say, what, no planes, that's ridiculous, and I say to the audience, and you know, we also are on the tapes and we also are on the videos and on the news, they must have been real. How can they not have been real? And, I just then go to show them the physical damage that we discussed a little bit earlier on, you can clearly see that just looking at, like, the Edna Cintron, where she's standing there, and, it can't have been very particularly hot, and the shape of the holes, with these quarter-inch aluminium wing struts cutting through the three-inch box girder steel, pieces of metal, it's just,
It's just preposterous.
Yeah,
it's kind of like Larry Bird, the basketball player. They used to say, over the famous Boston Celtic basketball player, he could shoot the threes, he could fake people out, even though he's kind of a slow white boy, 6'9". He could make defenders look silly, and they would say about him that he's in. Are you, Larry, into the degree of difficulty? It's almost like the perpetrators are. Look at what we can do. We can fool anybody with pretty absurd results. Well, you are listening to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we have two wonderful guests from England. We're discussing 9/11 and the whole psyop of 9/11. How did they do it? We are going to be back for more intelligent discussion about 9/11. So hurry back. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I am your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you would like to call in and speak with Andrew Johnson or Richard D. Hall from England, please listen to the following number, 218-862-9829. That number again, 218-862-9829. Andrew, I fancy you are expert on psychological operations in a way you probably weren't 10 years ago. You have learned a great deal. We all have. We were kind of babes in the woods. And I treasure your remark about internet forums. I mean, once upon a time, internet forums and this whole kind of horizontal democratization of the media, which is still a great thing. We're getting away from three big media companies, broadcast companies, that kind of thing. So it's great, but it's been a little disappointing. And to some extent, these forums and all this flaming and incivility on the web, some of it is due to the anonymity, which, yeah, it has. On the one hand, you say, well, people ought to be able to participate without risking their career. But on the other hand, it just frees people to be monstrous, really. And where are we going on this front? I wonder if productivity, the way I'd put it as an economist, can't be improved somehow.
Well, I mean, I think it's a very tough one because, as you say, there is a good reason on some forums for having anonymity. If you are disclosing certain information or you are giving a certain type of analysis.
Hey, hold that thought, Andrew, because we have a call.
Okay.
Steve dropped, but we have area code 561. Go ahead, 561.
Hey, what's up? It's train wreck Tommy.
Okay, Tommy. Tommy is an eyewitness to 9/11, and he saw, I interviewed him on this show a month or so ago, and Tommy saw what he described as a DC-3 type aircraft fly over his head into the South Tower. So go ahead, Tommy.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi.
I couldn't even imagine anyone saying there was no plane, because not only was I there, I heard it, I saw it. Now, what I saw And what it was could have been two different things, but I can understand when people are under stress, whatever, they see things differently. But I've been around planes a lot. I've flown planes. I've been in work on planes. I've seen the insides of planes. And when I first came out of the South Tower from the subway exit, because downstairs it was all blown out, you couldn't walk, the lights are out. So I had to come out through the southern exit. As I was walking on the ground, I could see all the zinc-coated aluminum pieces from the plane that came through the North Tower. So it got shredded. And unless they set it up to blow metal pieces all over the ground, you know, that would be a little complicated. But it was absolutely metal and big, good, decent-sized chunks. So I knew it wasn't a helicopter. It had to be a jet because it's all zinc-plated. Whenever you fly,
yeah, but Tommy, you didn't see any tail section or big engine parts.
I couldn't have, because the North Tower, I was on the south side, so the North Tower got hit from north to south, so the plane had to come through like a cheese grater through the whole entire building. Now, when I was walking, I saw the pieces on the ground.
That's not
later on. Later on, I was under the South Tower.
Okay, hey, Tommy, what is your question? You want to put a question to our guest?
Well, I'm just giving them eyewitness testimony. They don't seem to have too many eyewitnesses that
were standing there that
know what they're talking about.
Did you witness?
I was under the South Tower and heard and watched the plane hit directly over my head.
Tommy, if you were listening
debris,
to the show,
the debris
you would
came
realize
down, I ran under a payloader across the street.
We're trying to reconcile two things, Tommy. One is the lack of the usual evidence from an airplane crash. One, and with the fact that credible witnesses like you saw and heard an airplane.
Well, I'm telling you, I saw all the airplane pieces on the ground from the North plane hitting the plane hitting the North Tower and coming through.
I don't think any of the three of us disagree with you at all. And we're not trying to say that
nothing,
you, you know, obviously we're not trying to say that you didn't see what you saw, because obviously you did see it.
Did you see the alleged impact of the second plane? Yeah, I saw the impact,
and I was under it when the impact happened, and I was underneath a payloader when all the debris fell down on the ground, but it wasn't airplane parts when it fell. It was just paper and garbage like that. But, you know, I've been around a lot of planes, and when I saw it hit, it looked to me, it didn't look like a big 757. It looked like a DC-3, like an old one of those, you know, the ones the drug runners use with the big tail wing. It looked like one of those,
Can you tell me whether it would be a bigger plane than the alleged plane or a smaller plane? Because I know some of the model numbers, but I don't know all the different sizes.
Smaller plane. A DC-3 is like an old, you know, twin engine. It was definitely a twin engine, but it looked smaller than a 757.
But Tommy, did it look like a prop plane, a propeller-driven plane to you?
No, it was a jet. It had plenty of. It was loud. Cool. Because it was flying low, you can hear it coming.
Okay.
It was really loud.
So, did it look as big as a 737 Boeing? You know, which is considerably small. It's a, you know,
to me, it looked like that size. And honestly, I thought it was like an old DC-3 jet. You know, one of the really old ones.
Well, that's part of the problem is reconciling many credible witnesses, or at least certainly dozens, who all saw a different type of plane image. That's part of the problem. Why this inconsistency?
Well, I think in your mind you think they just stole some junky plane and put it into the building, because you'd never think in a million years that they'd actually hijack a plane full of people and send it into the building. And about an hour later, I was listening to someone who had a car radio on, and they said there were 757s hijacked full of people, and I was like, whoa. And I didn't sit there thinking, well, I was wrong, and there's no way there were 757s. I said, well, it's just, you know, it happens quick, and maybe it was that big. I don't know.
If I can interject, if you watch what's called the Herzakhani footage, and you watch it once, then you will say that was a plane hitting a building. But if you slow it down and analyze it and add to that some other video from other angles, it is not a plane hitting a building. But if you just watch that video clip once, you will be convinced that that's what you saw. So you were convinced just as I was convinced when I saw the video. But having analyzed the video closely, the impact dynamics are, they're a cartoon. They're not a real event.
Yeah, they're impossible physics. for example, to have an entire, basically,
well, I know
what you're saying, aircraft penetrate the tower and disappear inside.
But I'm not saying it was a 757. It could have been something, a twin engine that's a lot faster than a 757.
But if it was physically an object which was somewhat smaller plane than the alleged 767, then you would still have the problems with the wings breaking off and the tail breaking off at some point before much of that structure entered into the building.
Exactly. Well,
so that would have broken off.
Let me point out a physical fact about the South Tower event, and that is it's only 39 feet from the outer wall to the core. 39 feet from the outer wall to the core, and a 767 is 159 feet long. So most of the plane has got to be outside of the tower.
Yeah. That's a good point.
Whichever plane you think it is, you need to verify that plane can go at 583 miles per hour at sea level, because that is what was seen in all of the video
footage. That's impossible. Right. Now, the government story is impossible, but we still have to, and I think Richard's on to something really important here with this 3D modeling, that the flight paths of these airplane images are all identical.
There's one question which people might ask is, okay, let's just say it was an illusion, however they've done it. Why did they fly their illusion at 583 miles per hour and not at a more realistic speed, which would be, say, 300 or even less miles per hour? There's two reasons that I can think of. One is that there was something inside, wrapped inside their illusion, whether that be a missile or something, that could not go any slower than 583 miles per hour. And the other is that if the illusion was played at 300 miles per hour, it would have looked even worse. It would have been obvious that this was not a real impact. So they've perhaps played it at the optimum speed that, that plane, at 35,000 feet can go 583 miles per hour. So, yeah, we'll get away with it. Maybe they've been practicing it in the desert against a mountain and they've done it at 300 miles an hour and thought, no, we're not going to get away with that, lads. Let's try it at 500. you see what I mean? So they've maybe tried it at a different speed.
Sure. I mean, Richard, let's also think about if you've created the 3D model with the software that you've got, what software have they got? And what did they have in 2001, to simulate these things?
Yeah, and people can download from our website.
I can tell you it was loud.
3D model.
It wasn't like it sounded like a 757 with that high jet whine. It didn't sound like that. It sounded like a roar.
We're up to time.
The time has flown, gentlemen from England, Andrew Johnson and Richard D. Hall. Now, Andrew's website is checktheevidence.com. Oh, good. Yeah, I've forgotten that. Okay. And Richard D. Hall's is richplanet.net. Please visit those sites to learn more. I am your host on the Reynolds Reveal, Morgan Reynolds, and my website is nomoregames.net. Visit that. So come on back next week when I'm going to interview a fellow economist about what's going on in this crazy political economy named Bill Anderson. So come on back next week for another good show.